I'm Christopher Lydon, with my one-time reporting colleague at the New York Times, Chris Hedges, who's become a sort of Mr. Bad News about our culture, our empire, our media. It's all dying or dead, he writes in the diagnosis that you can't put down, Empire of Illusion. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, from the Watson Institute at Brown University. Chris Hedges, welcome to Conversation again. Mr. Bad News, as you remember, was the nickname, when I first went to the New York Times, of a guy named Alden Whitman, who wrote the obituaries of great figures for the paper of record. So when Alden Whitman came to interview you about your life, you were supposed to know that it was almost over. And that's you now, in a sense, Chris Hedges, the obituary guy for the society, for the regime. I want to know, then what? When you learn or do you decide that the public stage, and even page one of the newspaper or the TV news, is as phony as pro wrestling, is there anything to do about it? I want to know about your own touchstones of reality, your own refuges from illusion. I want to ask the question that Harold Bloom put to himself after a lifetime of reading the great ones. His title was, Where Will Wisdom Be Found? Or should you start simply by recounting how a straight news dude, one of those gentlemen from the Times, became a Cassandra? What turned you, Chris Hedges?
I don't think I was turned because I began my career overseas as a freelance reporter covering the war in El Salvador and didn't come back to the United States for 2 decades. The criteria that I used to justify my work, and I primarily covered conflicts, was informed by a kind of moral outrage of what was happening, whether it was to the campesinos in El Salvador, to those trapped in Sarajevo during the war in Bosnia, which I also covered for the New York Times. When I spoke publicly about figures like Slobodan Milosevic or about the military regime in El Salvador or about what the Israelis were doing in Gaza, I could do so with a kind of freedom and a kind of critique that when I came back to the United States was unacceptable. To speak about the Bush administration and make the same kinds of judgments that I had been making overseas was unpalatable at the New York Times. And, of course, that is why I got into trouble for denouncing the Iraq war in the months and weeks leading up to the war. So I don't think that it was so much a change within myself as an inability after having been a war correspondent to come back and confront my own culture in the way that I had confronted cultures and figures overseas.
I'm just thinking that the media is deeply entwined in the whole story you're telling. I keep wondering, and let me just say, I'm fascinated by your disenchantment with journalism because I share a lot of it. But I keep wondering, who would we count on to tell us that our economy, our culture, our democracy are all in perhaps terminal danger? Years ago, I would have said, well, the New York Times will tell us one day. But where do you turn? Where should we turn? Where does a citizen go?
Well, there are voices on the margins or fringes of society. Political philosophers like Sheldon Wolin, who taught at Berkeley and later at Princeton, just published a great book, Democracy Incorporated, which was reviewed in one American newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, because I wrote the review. There are figures like Stiglitz, Michael Hudson. I mean, they're there. But unfortunately, they have been, and as you correctly point out, pushed out of the mainstream. I mean, if you look at the editorial page of the New York Times, you have Thomas Friedman, a so-called liberal, juxtaposed with David Brooks, a so-called conservative. Yet, in fact, both of these figures embraced the inevitability of globalization, supported the military adventures in both Iraq and Afghanistan. What they argue over is what Freud called the narcissism of minor difference. And this, I think, is writ large throughout the culture. The system itself, the bankrupt, unregulated, capitalism, the moral nihilism that infects the society, is not questioned or challenged. Structures are not questioned and challenged. Assumptions are not questioned and challenged. And that's true in the media, but it's also true in academia. You know, look at any economics department of any major university. There has been a kind of almost Maoist orthodoxy that has been swallowed by the culture at large. You know, it began with the end of history, this somehow idea that we had reached the final accumulation of human progress. So this is a utopian vision, just as globalization is. The result of what was happening around us, increased unemployment, environmental degradation, the dismantling of our manufacturing base, the utter corruption of our political process. Sheldon Wolin correctly, I think, calls it inverted totalitarianism, by which he means that it's not classical totalitarianism and that it's not driven by a demagogue or a great leader. It finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. It isn't about, as classical totalitarian movements are, about tearing down old decaying structures and building new ones. You still, in the corporate state, pay homage to the Constitution, electoral politics, but the levers of power are so utterly corrupted that the citizen undergoes what citizens in this country have been undergoing for the last few decades, which is a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion. Now, all of that is disintegrating as people are losing jobs in what Lawrence Summers calls our jobless recovery. These jobs are not coming back. People don't have access to credit. And yet we still live in this empire of illusion, this belief that we can borrow our way back to the bubble economy of 2006, that somehow our empire can continue to expand without any kind of restraints. Again, it expands because we sell $2 billion of debt a day to the Chinese. I mean, it is a fantasy. It's magical thinking. And unfortunately, so much of our public intellectuals or those who are engaged in public debate have become courtiers. I look at Washington as a kind of Versailles. Courtiers are hedonists of power. I mean, look at television would be a perfect example. It's all about access to power. The whole coverage by the paper we used to work for, the New York Times, in the buildup to the Iraq War reduced reporting itself to stenography, where figures would show up at offices in the White House, whether it was Lewis Scooter Libby or someone else, and have mendacious, completely fabricated stories dictated to them. These stories would then go on the front page of the New York Times, and then Dick Cheney would appear on Tim Russert's morning show, be asked about the New York Times story and confirm it. It has a kind of almost Kafkaesque quality to it, an absurdist quality to it.
Chris, hold it a moment. We've been interviewing poets lately, as it happens, sort of an alternative authority. And the poet Rosanna Warren jarred me the other day. She was speaking actually about reading Homer all her life. But then she referred to the times we live in. And I said, what about our times? And she said basically that her adult life had been framed by the wars of a rapidly declining empire, flailing and failing to consolidate its power. She said, I'm an anguished witness to my country's agonies and confusions. And my first thought was, don't we all share that feeling at some level? But then why – the real question is why do so few say it? And why do we hear it from a poet and not from the so-called news institutions? I mean, not necessarily the New York Times, but I mean, how about Harper's Magazine?
Well, Harper's probably done a better job than anyone else. But I'm not disagreeing with you. Why don't we hear it? Well, because that sense, moral sensitivity, has been utterly obliterated.
But I also wondered, Chris, there's a related question here. Is this why the media is going broke? I mean, aren't these two things related in the end? The New York Times is bust.
Yes. Yeah,
so are the networks.
Well, I mean, the crisis that we face is not so much an economic crisis as a moral crisis. The utter cynicism on the part of a very well-paid media who have become, in essence, hedonists of power, which is what courtiers are, that the truth no longer matters, that that sacred contract that a great reporter makes between the viewer or the reader to tell them the truth is no longer relevant. It's a matter of balance. We can put on one mendacious pundit to balance out another mendacious pundit. It's the bifurcation of the world into two sides, when in fact there often aren't two sides. It is the, you know, being able to write stories, and if you look, for instance, at the coverage in the New York Times, I don't want to pick on the Times. I mean, the Times is better than most, but after the Israeli 22 days of bombing and attacks in Gaza, the Times went in and to a village where they interviewed eyewitnesses about atrocities that had been carried out against civilians, and yet every other paragraph was given over to an Israeli spokesperson who wasn't there. And the end result of a story like that is that you can believe whatever you want to believe. And that kind of cynicism, I think, has infected the media under this sort of creed of objectivity. They have embraced a kind of moral bankruptcy. It has allowed them not to confront, as you point out, the utter degradation, physical, economic, political, that has undergone the country, because they still play by these arcane rules, which were established at the end of the 19th century for money.
But their bottom lines are failing. You'd think somebody would see a warning in that. But I want to change the question a little bit. In Boston politics years ago, there was this expression people would say about another person, a lying politician or something. You'd say, oh, so-and-so, he wouldn't tell you your coat was on fire. To me, the question is, who would tell you your empire's on fire? Who would tell you that your democracy's on fire? And I want you to be fairly specific about the people you read and trust and go to in this world of illusion. Sorry.
Well, let me first say that, you know, remember when Carter put on his sweater and tried to tell us about the energy crisis and the blowback from the truth?
Yeah.
When you look at a decaying civilization, and you can go back and read Joseph Roth writing about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, read Cicero writing about the end of the Roman Republic, you see that all of these dying civilizations are characterized by, number one, a bankrupt elite, but also by a flight into illusion. This is what drove Cicero nuts over the Roman arena, that it poisoned civil and political discourse. And so when you have someone, and I just use that small example of Carter, getting up and trying to speak the truth, it is so unpalatable in an empire of illusion that these people are hounded, as Carter was, out of office. Who do I trust? Ralph Nader, Dennis Kucinich, Joseph Stiglitz, Sheldon Wolin. There are Andrew Bacevich at BU. There are people there that if you are proactive, you can go find.
Do you trust Michael Moore, Chris?
Michael Moore is an entertainer.
Okay.
Michael Moore is about street theater.
Okay.
He's funny. He's clever. It's agitprop. It's not journalism.
Who else do you read? I want to know that. I want a list of the Hedges touchstones, including including the ancients. I mean, you say Cicero. You re-educated yourself around Homer too.
Well, I read a lot of fiction. I'm reading Curzio Malaparte's Caput at the moment, along with Sheldon Wolin's 1960 classic Politics and Vision. I don't own a television. I think that in order to maintain independent thought, one must build walls, a kind of private monastic retreat in which they can ward off the infection of the idiom of popular culture and advertising. And that has to be done proactively because it's everywhere. You go to a gym and it's banks of televisions. We are just assaulted day in and day out. And I remember the shock of that coming back after almost two decades abroad. It was difficult in New York City, where I was living, to contemplate everything, to find the capacity to contemplate because everything moved. And it's why I spent so much time in the Metropolitan Museum of Art because objects didn't move. One could actually stand in front of a Van Gogh or a Vermeer for 20 or 30 minutes and think about what the artist was trying to say. That constant shifting of images, of noise, of sound, cartoons are a perfect example of that, I think cut off the capacity for thought. The danger of having a media saturate you with phrases and outlooks is that even when you feel that kind of disquiet, which I think you're correct in saying that many do feel, you don't have the vocabulary by which to express it. I saw that in the former Yugoslavia, where you would interview Muslim militiamen in Mostar who literally were shooting their former neighbors across the width of a street, and you would ask them why. They would repeat back to you the absurdities that the cliches and slogans and jargon that were pumped out through the electronic media, which were controlled, of course, by the nationalist forces in whichever enclave you were living. And yet they knew somehow there was a kind of illogic to the war itself. At night, they would shout back across the street, you know, how's Slavica, who they, you know, they played soccer, they went to school, they married these people. And yet by day, they would then again begin to kill each other. I think language is key. And I work very, very hard to protect myself so that I don't speak in the language in which we're given. That's the first step. And I read. I live in a house that is, you know, I have 5,000 books and no television, and I don't socialize very rarely because I read every night. I found very few dinner parties that can compete with a good book.
Add the Robert Frank show of photographs at the Metropolitan Museum to the list of things to do standing still. Pictures of the Americans, 50 years old, and extraordinarily wonderful and rich and exemplary. I wonder, though, do you read journalism of any kind? The FT, The Guardian, The London Review. Do you find any refuge in offshore journalism?
Well, I'm still a news junkie. I read The New York Times every day.
So do I.
I will read The Wall Street Journal. I think, in fact, they're reporting on some of the economic mess after everything collapsed. Nobody was doing it before it collapsed. Has been probably the best in the country. I certainly try and read the British press, especially for international news. I read the London Review of Books. I read the FT. I think and when you've been in the profession, you know bylines. You know Gretchen Morgenson is good. If Gretchen Morgenson leaves the Times and goes somewhere else, she's still somebody you want to go read. You have to be proactive in terms of going out and finding that information, but it is there, and the internet has been a useful tool for that.
Chris Hedges, what sort of news substitute do you find online?
Well, online you have access, for instance, to the English edition of Haaretz, which does probably the best coverage of the Palestinians of any paper in the world. So through the internet, you have the ability to reach out to credible and good news sources. I think the internet is also a curse in that most people ghettoize themselves. They tend to retreat to websites that reinforce their own opinion. And I think we know that the news websites, despite the numbers of hits, one of the things the New York Times doesn't tell you about all their unique visitors, which I think is a month, supposedly 20 million or something, is that the average visitor on the website only spends 7 minutes on the site. The average reader of the New York Times, at least in the last survey I saw, will spend 40 minutes reading the paper. It's very different. People are going to the New York Times not to actually read, but for the same reason they go to Google News headlines. And that's one of the reasons why advertisers are not migrating to the web and why large news organizations like the New York Times are in very, very serious financial trouble.
Mm. Chris Hedges, on the way to writing your now classic book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, you went to the Harvard Divinity School to mine theology and the wisdom writers. And I keep wondering, is that a path that lots of other people can take?
I think reaching back and studying in depth other cultures and other societies is vital because you can see how even the greatest minds like Aristotle had trouble challenging the assumptions of the world around them. I mean, for instance, Aristotle thought we would never abolish the institution of slavery. It frees you from the cant of modernity, of modern culture. And many of the great writers, the great philosophers, the great theologians, the great ethicists, the great artists grappled with these fundamental issues, the ambiguity of good and evil, a life of meaning, and to somehow lose that trajectory, to ignore those voices that came before. It's why I think theater is so important. Mm. Theater is, for me, an almost religious experience in that it gives voices to the dead. It brings the dead back to life, whether it's Shakespeare, whether it's Ibsen, whether it's Chekhov. And we can juxtapose the struggles that those who went before us had with our own struggles, to somehow believe that we are the culmination, that time is linear, that we are progressing morally, is to ignore human history and human nature, and essentially to remain in a state of infantilism. That's what illusion is about. If we had an understanding of what the dying days, the twilight hours of great civilizations were like, whether the Ottoman Empire, the Roman Empire, the Aztec Empire, we would be able to see all of the flashing lights, the warning signs around us.
Mm.
But I think that the illiteracy which has gripped the country, a third of this country is either illiterate, 42 million Americans, or some 50 million Americans read at a fourth or fifth grade level. But then you have people who are technically literate who don't read anymore. And that shift from a print-based culture into an image-based culture, the belief that somehow, you know, how we are made to feel is a form of knowledge, propaganda, you know, being a kind of ideology, is the hallmark of a totalitarian state. Totalitarian states are image-based, spectacle-based states. And we have set the ground for a seamless transfer from a democracy into a kind of a corporate state. And with the corporate state always comes the rise of the surveillance or the security state. And we lack the capacity, having been unmoored from print and relying on skillfully manipulated images, to fight back.
Hmm. The
danger with living, you know, people strive towards a dream, but you live within an illusion. And the real danger is that when you live within an illusion about yourself, about where your nation is headed, and we see it with the environmental crisis is a perfect example. We are literally destroying the ecosystem that sustains the human species. The scientists, including Hansen at NASA and others, Bill McKibben, I mean, it's all out there. And yet we are mesmerized by these celluloid shadows on the wall. And the danger is that as the gap opens or widens between the illusion of the world we think we live in and the reality of that world, as we suddenly find that these jobs are not coming back, that unemployment benefits are running out and we're going to try and live on, courtesy of Bill Clinton's draconian welfare reform, $143 a month, that they are going to come and foreclose our house, that we can't get credit to sustain the lifestyle. I mean, real wages have dropped in this country since the 70s. What you've done is render huge segments of the population it's a kind of childishness, which makes them emotionally, intellectually, and psychologically unprepared for what it is they are about to face. And they will react like all children, which is to reach out for demagogues who promise a new glory, vengeance, and moral renewal.
Chris Hedges, hold on.
I watched it play out in Yugoslavia.
Come back to the force that gives us meaning. When, and I'm thinking specifically of the rethink of the plans in Afghanistan underway at the White House even as we speak. What happens when the meaning that war gives us back is shocking or repulsive or frightening or feels like repetition compulsion or maybe the end of days? I mean, when does that kind of dread set in actively and make a difference?
Well, war has ramifications that are different depending on whether you're fighting it or whether you're watching it. Part of the alienation that veterans feel, at least those that are self-aware when they return from Iraq and Afghanistan, is that the supporters of the war at home believe in this idealized or romantic vision of war that has no correlation with the reality of war. And so you have a kind of existential crisis whereby many of these veterans, of course, you know, traumatized and then re-traumatized through successive deployments, understand an existential truth, which is that we are not a virtuous nation, that God does not ensure victory, that all of the institutions that have fed us this vision of ourselves have lied, that our capacity for evil is as great as those we oppose. And that division, coupled, of course, with high unemployment, creates a volatile, alienated, disenchanted class. You see it leaping up around the edges of American society, whether it's these people who carry weapons to tea parties or these militia groups like Oath Keepers that are built essentially off kind of Free Corps ex-veterans who've come back and can't integrate back into the society. And in a time of economic collapse, and if you watch closely what's happening now to the dollar with trading partners like Russia and the Middle East beginning to trade in their own currency, walking away from the dollar as the reserve currency means that we are flirting with the specter not only of inflation but hyperinflation. And once that begins, then the moral order is turned completely upside down. As Lenin understood, when you debauch a currency, you destroy a governmental system itself. So I think that the danger that we face by not confronting the reality around us is one that has the potential to plunge us into a very frightening dystopia.
The empire is cooked, you keep saying. And as I say, it's hard. I wouldn't want to argue against you on that, Chris. But I'm also thinking that we live in the ruins of other empires. The British Empire, for example, is gone, but its language, its influence, its wealth, its privilege, its brand names, a lot of them, are still out there. And the colonial institutions, even after the power is gone, get recycled. What survives of American hegemony if, in fact, it's over?
Well, it is over. We can't continue to borrow to sustain either a level of consumption or the empire that we demand. It's just a question of when, and it's how do we respond. I don't think that learning to live without the piles of junk that has been bequeathed to us by consumer culture is going to impoverish our lifestyle. I don't think that learning a new humility as empire is dismantled is a negative. We will have to learn another language other than the language of force, by which we speak to most of the rest of the world, certainly those in the Middle East. It doesn't necessarily mean the end of hope, and it doesn't necessarily mean the end of a life of meaning or a life of richness. It just means a different kind of life. The danger is not grasping this reality. That's the danger, because if we're not prepared for this reality, if we continue to live as I think perhaps we are the most illusioned nation on the planet, then we will end up like Yugoslavia. Very similar, you know, the war in Yugoslavia was caused by the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia. It had nothing to do with ancient ethnic hatreds. And it vomited up figures like Slobodan Milosevic and Radovan Karadzic and Franjo Tuđman. And Weimar Republic did the same. So did the collapse of Tsarist Russia. I mean, you know, the list is sort of endless. That's the danger. What remains? I think that unfortunately, American culture or cultures, for we once had many cultures with their own iconography and aesthetic and immigrant cultures, regional cultures, a decentralized press that gave expression to local communities, was dismantled and destroyed in the 20th century and replaced with mass corporate culture. And when we talk about American culture, what we're really talking about is corporate culture, which is something different. And the drive of corporate culture was to implant the need for consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. It was and of course, drawing on Freud as Bernays and others did, it was about manipulating people, appealing to subliminal desires and anxieties, often creating those anxieties to fuel a kind of wild orgy of consumptible products that were supposed to sort of ameliorate our alienation and atomization and loneliness and despair. And all of that is falling down around us. And yet we haven't recognized that reality even in the midst of the destruction. It's not unique. I mean, I would sit around Pristina in Kosovo with friends of mine, you know, urbane, educated, multilingual Kosovar Albanians, and say, look, the Kosovo Liberation Army has just attacked this town. And they would say it doesn't exist. There won't be a war. Same thing happened in Sarajevo. There's that emotional incapacity or psychological incapacity to understand how fragile the world is around us and how rapidly it can disintegrate. And I think having been a war correspondent and having lived in disintegrated or societies that did disintegrate, I'm much more conscious. You know, I can walk in my supermarket and imagine all of the windows knocked out and the shelves bare and the neon lights hanging by their wires with punched in holes in the roof because I've seen it. And there's that always that dual capacity to understand how swiftly and pervasively a society can collapse.
Let me ask you, Chris, does it comfort you at all that the New York Times says the American people are disillusioned with the war in Afghanistan in a certain sense before the battle is really joined?
No, because what the citizens care about, and let's go back to Sheldon Wolin and inverted totalitarianism, is irrelevant. And you can see it in the healthcare debate. You can see it, for instance, in the first bailout proposal, $700 billion. Constituent calls across the political spectrum were 100-1 against the bailout. Some of the most eloquent speeches against the bailout were delivered by right-wing Republicans from Texas on the House floor. And yet it passed anyway. Why? Because the corporations wanted it passed. The rise of the corporate state has left the citizenry without a mechanism, which used to be the government, to protect its rights and interests. And the healthcare, the debacle over the healthcare debate, where we are going to be forced, in essence, to buy their defective product. They can still ratchet up co-payments and premiums, especially on the elderly. They can still dump the sick and the chronically ill when they don't want to pay for their medical bills anymore. I mean, not only were half of all bankruptcies in this country caused by people who couldn't pay their medical bills, but 7 out of 10 of those people actually had insurance. And that kind of parasitic abuse of the American public is going to continue unabated unless we challenge the corporate state itself.
Last question, Chris Hedges. We elected a president who promised literally a kind of transformation. I don't want to argue Obama politics so much as just to ask, is transformation, very popular word in this culture, is transformation an illusion?
Well, we elected a brand. We elected a presidential candidate who campaigned, like his rival, primarily on a personal narrative. You had rallies where people were chanting slogans, "Yes, we can," which they stole, by the way, from FedEx Kinko's. It was campaign as experience. It was, again, with $600 million worth of campaign financing, a very effective way of making us feel a certain way about a candidate. But Obama does not threaten the core of the corporate state any more than George W. Bush threatened the core of the corporate state. And I think that that has been more than evidenced by Obama's willingness to continue the looting of the U.S. Treasury, the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history. In the 17th century in England, speculators were hung. In our society, they are given tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer bailouts and run the government.
Chris Hedges, it's a peculiar sort of high to get down with you and with the Empire of Illusion. You know I have always admired you, Chris, and I always will. Thank you for this book and thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Chris Hedges, whose book is Empire of Illusion. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern helped us sort it all out. Post your own scenario of empire, your own antidotes to illusion, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.